So greetings in the name of Jesus, our precious Savior. It's exciting to be able to share again this morning. Sometimes I wonder, Lord, how am I going to be able to stand up here before all of these people and share like this? But he gives me the strength, and it is amazing to see how our God works. Let's go to Exodus chapter 26. So I'll start like I usually do. The tabernacle. Can someone define the word tabernacle for me? God's dwelling place. How about another definition? It was being a witness. I'm not sure. Another thought that I have is tent. A tent or dwelling place. Okay. Now, three people. I want you, for those of you that were here on my other two talks on the tabernacle, I would like to hear one thing from three different people that you remember about what was taught on the tabernacle. Anything that stood out to you? I know it's been a while. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and God is concerned with detail. He's concerned with the details in our own lives as well. And the one thing that I had mentioned, God is not haphazard, so neither should we be haphazard with things that we do in our work for him. Preparing and studying is a good thing, and also for whatever work or ministry God has for you and I, to take it seriously, even the small details in our lives. Oh, yes, the details all have a purpose. Mm-hmm. The manna represented God's provision. Aaron's rod that had budded is the priesthood, the chosen people, the gods that God had set up, a chosen people to lead, and then of course the Ten Commandments is God's law given to us. One more. God has an eye for beauty. He creates all things beautiful. Okay. So we've had our introduction. I'm going to skip ahead to where we are. I'm going to touch on... Okay. So take a look with me to Exodus 26, starting in verse 30. Let us hear the word of God. And thou shalt rear up in the tabernacle according to the fashion thereof, which was showed thee in the mount. And thou shalt make a veil of blue and purple and scarlet and fine twined linen of cunning work. With cherubims shall it be made. So the first thing I want you to notice here in verse 30, God says that tells Moses he is to rear up the tabernacle according to the fashion thereof, which was showed in the mount. So we see several times, and if you remember, there were other verses in the preceding chapters that God said the same thing. Make it after the pattern that I show you. So God is emphasizing and making very important to Moses, this has to be done the way I tell you. Make it the way I showed you. According to the fashion thereof. The same pattern. So now, looking at verse 31, we see that he is commanded to make a veil. If you look at the picture up on the screen, you'll see the inside of the tabernacle. This would be the holy place, looking down in from the top. Now, obviously, the holy place would have been covered over the top with the coverings that we talked about. But here, it's shown open so we can see inside. Now notice, everything's covered in gold. Can you imagine being inside there and seeing the walls reflecting gold? How beautiful the interior would have been. Now, can someone tell me how would you see in there if it's covered? It's the light of the candle, the light of the candlestick. Yes. That was the only source of light within the tabernacle. Now, I'll touch on that a little more in a bit. But I want you to notice the hanging towards the back. That is the veil. Now, the veil, it says in verse 31, was made of several different types of thread or linen. We have blue and purple and scarlet and fine twine linen. So we have several different colors all meshed together. Now, the fine twine linen would have been the white. And we also notice, not only do we have these colors woven throughout the veil, we also are told that it is a veil of cunning work. Now, cunning carries the idea of being expertly done. And then we also notice that, as you can see here on this depiction, we have cherubim woven within the veil. Now, as I always say, this is just an artist's depiction. We don't exactly know what the cherubim would have looked like on the veil or how the colors were brought together to form this veil. But we know the colors, and the colors do have significance. I'm not going to touch on that this morning, but the colors do have significance. Now, let's look at verse 32. And thou shalt hang it, the veil, upon four pillars of shittim wood, overlaid with gold. Their hooks shall be of gold upon the four sockets of silver. So if you look at that picture with me, you can see that there's four pillars, and the pillars are overlaid with gold. At the base, you have your silver sockets. And we talked last time that the silver sockets are a representation of grace. And you can see lined along the walls there where the boards are, we have the sockets anchoring the walls of the tent. You can see them lined all along the sideboards. That would be the south side of the tabernacle. So we see that they're overlaid with gold and that their hooks are of gold. And there's four pillars. Now, in verse 33, God says, "And thou shalt hang upon the veil, hang up the veil under the tatches." Now, the tatches were the clasps that would hold the veil. "That thou mayest bring in thither within the veil the ark of the testimony, and the veil shall divide unto you between the holy place and the most holy." So what was behind the veil? The most holy place. And what was in the most holy place? The Ark of the Covenant. And that is where what resided? God's presence. God's presence resided there. On the mercy seat. So we find that this veil separates the most holy place from what you see here, which would be called the holy place. Separation. Separation from God. Man needed to be separated from God's holiness because of his sin and rebellion. Only one man was allowed to enter the holy place once a year, and that was the high priest. He was given that privilege of entering once a year to atone, to make an atonement for the children of Israel. But it was barred access other than that. So it shows that our sin and our rebellion against God separates us from him. It separates us from God. So the veil during that time, I'm sure, was a constant reminder to the people that sin was a separation. And a constant reminder of their sin, and that it also shows that we, the children of Israel, God had not completely finished his work of atonement yet. Now, let's go to verse 34. "And thou shalt put the mercy seat upon the ark of the testimony in the most holy place." So here, we have a break from the construction, and God is giving instructions to Moses on where to put certain items. So the mercy seat, where is the mercy seat to go? And God tells us it's to go upon the ark of the testimony. So the mercy seat is the lid for the ark of the testimony. And that is the place where God's presence would dwell, above the mercy seat between the cherubim. So God is saying that you are to put the mercy seat upon the ark in the most holy place. So if you look at this depiction, you can see within, they have a breakaway. You can see within, and you can also see beyond the veil, and within the most holy place, we have the ark with the mercy seat on top, set in place. Now, if you look with me at verse 35, God has another article that he gives instructions on where it ought to go. "And thou shalt set the table without the veil, and the candlestick over against the table on the side of the tabernacle toward the south." So if you look at this picture, we have the candle. The candlestick is on the south side. God gave instructions to place it there. And we have the table on the north side. So you can see the eastern gate, or so the eastern gate, and then the eastern door. The gate would have been the entrance to the court, and then you have the door, and then you have the veil. They all face east. And then the candlestick and the table were placed on either wall. So the candlestick on the south and the table on the north. Okay, let's look at verse 36. And thou shalt make an hanging for the door of the tent of blue and purple and scarlet and fine twined linen wrought with needlework. And thou shalt make for the hanging 5 pillars of shittim wood and overlay them with gold, and their hooks shall be of gold. And thou shalt cast 5 sockets of brass for them. So we see here in verse 36 that God tells Moses that he is to make a door for the tent. Now, if you look in this photo, we have the door out front and then the veil beyond it, behind. So the door gained access to the holy place, whereas the veil gained access to the most holy place. Now the door was made also of blue and purple and scarlet and fine twined linen. No cherubim this time, though. Or at least the Bible doesn't say cherubim. But verse 36 rather says that it was wrought with needlework. So we know that there was some sort of pattern, something woven within this cloth. Then if we look at verse 37, we also see that God told Moses that he is to make for the hanging 5 pillars of shittim wood. And you notice, if you look at the picture, there's 5 pillars rather than 4 for the veil. Also notice that the pillars of the door are also overlaid with gold, and their hooks are also of gold. And this time, the sockets that are holding the pillars are made of brass and not silver. The number 5 indicates grace in the Bible. And we can see that the door of the tabernacle has 5 pillars. Let's do a little comparison here so you can understand the veil and the door a little more deeply. So the veil has cherubims, 4 pillars, silver sockets, and it's a division. Now, the door has needlework, 5 pillars, but brass sockets. Those are the differences between the veil and the door. But the 2 things they share in common would be the blue, purple, scarlet, and fine twine linen, and the golden hooks. Notice that God, even within the tent itself, and especially within the holy place and the most holy place, reveals himself as a God of beauty. Okay, starting in chapter 27, we have the introduction to the brazen altar. And thou shalt make an altar of shittim wood, 5 cubits long and 5 cubits broad. Here we have the number 5 again, symbolizing grace. The altar shall be 4 square, and the height thereof shall be 3 cubits. So we have 5 by 5 by 3. Can anyone tell me what that translates to in feet? Does anyone remember what a cubit is? You got it. That's right. 7.5 foot by 7.5 foot by 4.5 foot high. So this artist's depiction of the brazen altar and the priests tending to their sacrificial duties reveals to us a fairly accurate depiction of the size. 4.5 foot would come to about my shoulders, and you can see that's about, would be, looks to be about 7.5 foot long. So this is no small altar. It could hold bullocks and rams. Okay, let's look at verse 2. And thou shalt make the horns of it upon the four corners thereof. His horns shall be of the same, and thou shalt overlay it with brass. One thing I want you to notice here is that this altar is made of wood underneath. It's made of shittim wood. That surprised me, that an altar where you burn, you have fire, would be made of wood. But then it was overlaid with brass. And the brass gave it the heat resistance that it needed. What would have happened if gold or silver had been used for the altar? Anybody know? We could probably guess. Yes, it would have melted. Fire will melt gold and silver. God knew what he was doing. He told him to make it out of brass. And brass can withstand the fire. So here in verse 2, we see horns, the mention of horns. Well, one might think, what do horns have to do with sacrifices or an altar? Well, horns in the Old Testament, you'll find many times, symbolize strength and power. So here God is saying to put horns on the four corners of the brazen altar. Now, we don't exactly know what these horns specifically looked like, but he tells specifically to put them in the four corners. I'll give some more details on horns on the next slide. Let's look at verse 3. And thou shalt make his pans to receive his ashes, and his shovels, and his basins, and his flesh hooks, and his fire pans, all the vessels thereof thou shalt make of brass. So we see everything here, all of the accessories. You can see in the picture, they are made of brass. And thou shalt make for it a grate of network of brass. And upon the net shalt thou make four brazen rings in the four corners thereof. So if you look at the photo I have at the top, you'll see grate. The grate is where the animals were laid to burn, and their ashes would fall through and be scooped out. In verse 5, God says, and thou shalt put it under the compass of the altar beneath, that the net may be even to the midst of the altar. So we have the grate in the center. And thou shalt make staves for the altar, staves of shittim wood, and overlay them with brass. So just as the Ark of the Covenant and the table of showbread, this altar was to be carried with poles overlaid with brass. And you can see in the picture here the poles sticking through the rings. I don't know how heavy this would have been, but I imagine it would have taken more than four men to carry it. And the staves shall be put into the rings, and the staves shall be upon the two sides of the altar to bear it. Hollow with boards shalt thou make it, as it was showed thee in the mount, so shall they make it. So here God again says, make it as I show you. Make it as I have told you in the mount. So remember, this is an altar of sacrifice. Men brought sacrifices to the altar daily for their sins. And if you study further in Exodus, there was a plethora of sacrifices on a daily basis that were offered at this brazen altar. Okay, let's take a look a little closer at the horns. What the significance of the horns represent. So look with me at 2 Chronicles 18, verses 9 and 10. 2 Chronicles 18, 9 and 10. Excuse me, I think that is the wrong passage. Yes, we shall move on from this one. Let's go to Psalm 18:2. I'm sorry about that. Psalm 18:2. Let's start in verse 1. I will love thee, O Lord, my strength. The Lord is my rock and my fortress and my deliverer, my God, my strength, in whom I will trust, my buckler and the horn of my salvation and my high tower. So here, David is praising God for victory. He's praising him that God is his rock, God is his fortress, God is his deliverer, and God is his strength. And then he says, in this God I will trust, for he is the horn of my salvation and my high tower. So we see here the horn showing victory and strength and power. There's another verse that I did not look up that came to my mind now that talks about when a man was being chased, he could run to the altar and cling to the horns of the altar and he was safe. Like a safety or a home base when being threatened. Psalm 75:10. We'll look at one more verse here. And if you want to learn more about the horns, there are many more passages in the Old Testament that declare and use the word horn. So let's look, starting in verse 9. But I will declare forever, I will sing praises to the God of Jacob. All the horns of the wicked also will I cut off, but the horns of the righteous shall be exalted. So the power of the wicked will be cut off, but here we see the strength and victory and power of the righteous will be exalted. So horns are on animals. If you look at these two deer, they're in a duel. And they're fighting. So we see here a representation, even in nature, that God's creation, that horns represent strength. This is the deer's strength. He's using his strength to try to fend off the other deer. Fending off predators, territorial competition can be fierce among animals. And we see that, I don't know how many of you have ever been to Yellowstone, but there's a lot of buffalo there. And my brother and I got to see a few buffalo fights when we were there several years ago. They are vicious, and they shake the ground if you're nearby. Thunderous. Some animals even duel to the death. But we see in Psalm 18:2 and in 75:10 that God is the one who fights for us because we don't have the strength to do it. God is the one who fights for us. Because if we look in 75:10, all the horns of the wicked also will I cut off, but the horns of the righteous shall be exalted. God is the one that fights. We also, in studying the behaviors of God's creatures, we also see that many times in a battle, they will lift their horns. So if they're standing in a normal position, their antlers or their horns will, most of the time, I mean, steers kind of come forward, but they'll go back, and then they'll put their head down and lift them and go in for a fight. So God also, if you look in the scriptures, God talks about lifting up the horn. In fact, here it is in Psalm 75, if you're still there with me, verse 4, it says, I said unto the fools, deal not foolishly, and to the wicked, lift not up the horn. Lift not up your horn on high. Speak not with a stiff neck. So God talks about lifting up the horn, getting ready for battle, flexing your muscles. So remember, the key to remember here with the brazen altar, it's got four horns, a horn on each corner. Remember that God is the horn of our salvation. Okay, let's look at the altar accessories, what were used. Turn back with me to Exodus chapter 27. And in verse 3, God talks about the altar accessories, implements and tools used to tend the brazen altar and all of the sacrifices that were performed. So if we look, God mentions pans to receive his ashes. So on this picture, you cannot read the cards that are written on the wall. But if you look to your top left, is a example of a pan. And that pan would receive the ashes of the animal, burned animals. Then we look at shovels. So the shovel would be first or second from the right, made of brass, and this photo has a shovel with some ornate design around the back edge. And God also commanded to make basins. Oh, I'm sorry, I can read those. Let's switch those two. The basin is actually the one on the top left. The pan is the one on the bottom left, and that was used to hold the ashes. And the basin was on the top. Now, the basins were used to hold blood. So the animals, as they were sacrificed, the basins would catch blood and be held in the basin. Now, God also commands to make flesh hooks. The flesh hooks were used to keep the carcass in the fire. So the flesh hooks, you could call it your fire poker, if you will. They were used to tend the fire as the animal would burn upon the altar. Of course, the flesh would, as it would burn, it would fall apart, if you will. So they needed to take this flesh hook and pull it, push it, whatever they needed to do, lift it, set it on, and so forth. So those were the flesh hooks, and you can see in the center there is it looks like a fork. So you can poke and stab the flesh and pick it up, move it around. This is a gruesome to think about, but it was what was required of God. It's what our sin has done. The fire pans. So God also commanded that fire pans be made. Now the fire pan is shown here on the far right. Now the fire pans were used to take coals of fire from the brazen altar and to be used elsewhere. In my study, one source had mentioned that it was used to, the coals would have been used to take to the burning incense altar within the holy place. We have not talked about the incense altar, but that was another article within the holy place, which is mentioned later in scripture. Then we also have various vessels, not depicted here on this photo, but vessels used for measuring cups of water, oil, and wine. And as you study Exodus and Leviticus and what the requirements of the priests were and how the sacrifices were to be done, there was often oil and wine used with the sacrifice, as a sacrifice, as cannot remember the name of it, but there was a certain sacrifice that required the olive oil and the wine. And it said how much was to be used or how much was to be given. And so they had vessels that would hold those items. Okay. That concludes the brazen altar. So let's take a look at verse 9 and see what God instructs Moses to build next. And thou shalt make the court of the tabernacle. For the south side southward, there shall be hangings for the court of fine twined linen of 100 cubits long for one side. And 20 pillars thereof and their 20 sockets shall be of brass. The hooks of the pillars and their fillets shall be of silver. So as we look here, God is giving dimensions and instructions for hangings of the outer court. Now, the outer court surrounded the tent. And God says here that it was 50 cubits wide and 100 cubits long. So the north side and the south side were 100 cubits. The west and the east were 50 cubits. So if we read in verse 11, he says, and likewise for the north side in length, there should be hangings of 100 cubits long, and his 20 pillars and their 20 sockets of brass, the hooks of the pillars and the fillets of silver. So we have 20 pillars along the north and south side, and then we have 10 pillars along the west side. Now, can anyone tell me, before I read on, why the east side would only have 6 pillars for the court wall? Because you have the gate. That's right. So the pillars are there, but they're not mentioned here because this is part of the court wall. And if we look in verse 12, it says, and for the breadth of the court on the west side shall be hangings of 50 cubits, their pillars 10, and their sockets 10. And the breadth of the court on the east side eastward shall be 50 cubits. The hangings of one side of the gate shall be 15 cubits, their pillars 3 and their sockets 3. So that's the one half on the one side of the gate. And then on the other side shall be hangings 15 cubits, their pillars 3 and their sockets 3 on the other side of the gate. And for the gate of the court shall be an hanging of 20 cubits of blue and purple, and scarlet, and fine twine linen, wrought with needlework, and their pillars shall be 4, and their sockets 4. So here we have the remaining pillars not mentioned in the court itself are now mentioned in the gate. So the size of this court, it was twice as long as it was wide. And to translate that from cubits to feet, it was approximately 150 feet by 75 foot wide. A fairly sizable court. And to note, within this court was the brazen altar behind the entrance gate. You found the brazen altar that was between the gate, the front gate, and the tent, which was the holy place and the most holy place. It's right where the brazen altar was. So when you entered that front gate, you saw the fire, you saw the sacrifices. And when the children of Israel, when they were required to bring a sacrifice, they had to find their way around that court, and they had to find the entrance, which is the east gate, and they had to go in through the east gate. And that was the way to get in, and they had to bring their sacrifice to the altar. Now, I won't mention what that alludes to, but you can think with me. The door, the gate, the veil. So imagine being an Israelite that needed to bring a sacrifice. You were met by this wall of white linen, and you had to find your way to this gate of fine twine linen and scarlet and purple and blue. And that you knew was the access point. Okay, verse 14. The hangings of one side of the gate shall be 15 cubits, their pillars and their sockets, 3. Sorry, I read that. Let's go to verse 16. And for the gate of the court shall be an hanging of 20 cubits of blue and purple and scarlet and fine twine linen wrought with needlework. So I want you to notice here, this gate is also wrought with needlework. What else was wrought with needlework? We just talked about this. The door. That's right. The door. The door was wrought with needlework. So it doesn't mention cherubims, but it mentions needlework. And their pillars shall be 4 and their sockets 4. All the pillars round about the court shall be filleted with silver. Their hooks shall be of silver and their sockets of brass. So here we have sockets of brass and fillets of silver. Rather than sockets of silver like the veil had. And notice in the picture, what's a little different about these pillars of shittim wood compared to inside the tent and surrounding the tent to make up the tent structure? They're not overlaid. They're raw in their form of shittim wood. The length of the court shall be 100 cubits and the breadth 50 everywhere. And the height, 5 cubits. So the height was 5 cubits. 7.5 foot high. If you're tall enough, you could jump and see over the top, I imagine. 7.5 foot. Yeah. But high enough to keep you from seeing in. The length of the court, and the vessels. The vessels of the tabernacle in all the service thereof and all the pins thereof and all the pins of the court shall be of brass. So here, everything made of brass for the external court. I want us to notice something. Of all the things that God has told Moses up to this point, starting in Exodus 25, where God begins to give Moses the instructions to build the tabernacle, God starts with the most central piece and works his way out. So in the Bible, God's instruction to Moses begins with the Holy of Holies, working its way to the outer court. God has the preeminence, for all things begin with him and are centered around him. So, note that all things begin with God. Let's look at another piece. Let's look at the lamp. If you remember before, God gave instructions on how to build the lamp with its knops and its bowls and being of gold. And might I add, pure gold. It was pure gold through and through, of one beaten work. So it wasn't pieced together. It was beaten out all in one piece. And it weighed 1 talent, which we estimated to be around 70 pounds in today's English units. A very fine piece of work. So if we look in verse 20, God says, and thou shalt command the children of Israel that they bring thee pure oil, olive beaten for the light, to cause the lamp to burn always. So this candlestick, this lamp, was always to be burning. It was the only source of light within the tent, and it was always to be burning. The Levites had the job of keeping it going. The priests were to keep it burning. And notice that pure oil, olive, beaten, was to be used for the light. So it wasn't to be crushed. It was to be olives that were beaten, and it was the pure oil that would flow freely from the olives. Now, if we look in verse 21, in the tabernacle of the congregation, without the veil, which is before the testimony, Aaron and his sons shall order it from evening to morning before the Lord. It shall be a statute forever unto their generations on the behalf of the children of Israel. So this candlestick, this light, was a testimony. It was to be burning at all times, and the priests were to carry out, they carried out their duties, and they provided the light for the priests to carry out their duties, and it gave them the light they needed within the tent. There's something I want us to note with the priests. We're going to touch on the priests now. The priests, the light provided three things. One, it provided light for the priests to carry out their duties, but it also, the priests were the ones to tend to it, and so it shows that God gives emphasis that the Lord gave emphasis that the priests were the ones to shine the light to the people. They were the spiritual leaders of the day. And it also shows that the priest gave access, it gained access to the truth of God. They were given that light to spread to others. So it's olive oil never ceasing, and the priests being the spiritual leaders. So I want you to consider a light in the darkness, a city set upon a hill. And of course, the candlestick has six branches with one center branch or trunk, and a number of seven being of completion. So my last topic I'd like to touch here is on the priesthood. So if we look at chapter 28, we begin with the priesthood, and God begins to give instructions on the priest's clothing and what they were to wear and how it was to be made. So starting in verse 1, we see, "And take thou unto thee Aaron thy brother, and his sons with him." So Aaron and his sons, "from among the children of Israel, that he may minister unto me in the priest's office, even Aaron, Nadab, and Abihu, Eleazar, and Ithamar, and Aaron's sons." So we see Aaron and his sons are given the direction that they are the ones that are to minister in the priest's office. The Levites are chosen as the priesthood. They are set apart from the other tribes. Verse 2, "And thou shalt make holy garments for Aaron thy brother, for glory and for beauty." So I want you to notice something here. God commands Moses to make holy garments for Aaron and his sons, for Aaron, specifically here in verse 2. He says, "For Aaron thy brother," for what purpose? For glory and for beauty. So the holy garments were to be set apart. It was a way to set the priests apart from the rest of the people. They had a special duty to tend to within the tabernacle. And God requires glory. He requires the glory. He deserves the glory. And he wanted the glory in these articles of clothing. And in Psalm 29, verse 2, we find that you're commanded to worship the Lord in the beauty of holiness. Did you ever consider that? That holiness is beautiful? Holiness is beautiful. So here we find that Aaron is to have garments that are made, and they're for glory and for beauty. And God is also a God of beauty. So they were fitting. They were fitting for the priesthood, for a richly adorned tabernacle. It would seem strange if God would give all of these specific beautiful details for the tabernacle, including gold and silver and all of this cunning work, and have the priests wear ordinary, everyday clothing. So we enjoy beauty too. I know I do. Take a look at our homes, our decorations, creation around us. Like to go camping or kayaking, enjoying God's beauty, his creation. Why is that? We're made in God's image. We also like to create, just like God does. And we like to create things of beauty, just as God does. So, I will stop there with the tabernacle for now. If you want to read on, you can see that God gives more instructions on the articles of the priest's clothing. He gives instructions on the breastplate and the ephod and the robe, the embroidered coat, the mitre and the girdle, all things that were worn by the priests and used in the priest's ministering. So I hope you've been richly blessed this morning by the instructions that God had given to Moses about the tabernacle. And I would encourage you, the Old Testament is full of things that we can learn about God, who he is, and also who Christ is. So I didn't touch on any of that because I'm specifically trying to get us to understand the building of the tabernacle. And if the Lord allows, I will be able to bring everything and tie all the knots together to show how it relates to today and the new covenant. So let's pray, and then I'll turn the service over.